And I'll tell you a story. We preached through Colossians a couple of years ago, before we did Mark, which has taken 2 years. It's so great. And when we were in Colossians, when I was beginning to, when we were preaching on the section there from chapter 2, verses 18 through 20, or 21, there was a woman in the congregation who read ahead and saw verse 22. And she was kind of on the edge at the time of her faith. And she read verse 22 and she said to the person next to her, "That's it. I'm not coming back next week. If this is what the Bible says about slavery and slaves, I can't be here." And she didn't come back. She came back once or twice the next year, but you didn't see her anymore because of this particular verse. Let me read it. "Slaves, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. And whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men." Now, it's among a number of different New Testament passages that command slaves to obey their masters. And it's often paired with commands to masters to treat your slaves well. And the problem, of course, is that there is not a command in this particular text. I think there are some elsewhere in Scripture. There's not a command in this particular text that implies in any way that the slave-master relationship is necessarily inherently wrong, or at least it seems to be that on the surface. And so it's a difficult passage. Have you ever been in a conversation, at least you have been in a conversation with a non-believer, and one of the first, and they've asked you about the Bible and slavery? Anyone? Okay, well, if you do go into these conversations or get into these conversations frequently, this will be a question that you're asked, so it's important to deal with it. The way I'd like to approach it is, from the very beginning. I want to go back and I want to talk about the Bible and slavery in the under the Old Covenant. That's going to be this Sunday. And if we can finish with that, next Sunday we'll do the slavery in the context of Rome and slavery in the New Covenant. And then on the last Sunday of the series, we'll talk about slavery and discipleship because, you'll notice in a lot of New Testament passages where discipleship is spoken of, you are called to serve or be the servant of Christ. Almost always, when the language of servanthood comes to the fore, the word being translated is doulos. Who knows what that means? Slavery. So we hear servant and we think someone who's maybe paid to clean a house or mow a lawn or something like that. First century people would not have thought that. They would have thought of someone being bought and paid for and owned by another person, a doulos, which is the word slave. I wish they would translate that uniformly throughout our Bibles instead of trying to soften it with the word servant, because I don't think that's accurate. So now, one of the biggest hurdles that we are going to face is the fact that, as I just mentioned, Romans had a certain idea in their head when they heard that word slavery. Americans do too. And what is the concept that we have in our head that we associate with this word slavery?
Antebellum Southern slavery.
Antebellum slavery. That's what we think of. What were some characteristics of slavery? If you've studied this, if you haven't, well, I'll tell you, you'll get an answer, but what were some characteristics of slavery in not just the Old South, in the United States prior to manumission. What was?
They kidnapped you from your place of origin.
Versus involuntary. No one entered into slavery as a willing participant. Usually the way it happened is, in Africa, for years, the tribal warfare had resulted in, when a particular village or a tribe was defeated, the women and children would be taken and made slaves, and the men would be killed. That's just the way it was. And nothing unique about that. That's not unique to their culture. That's something that you find pretty much in every culture. But at a certain point, the West needed labor. The North and the West needed labor. And so it became lucrative for these various African nations, African tribes, to not murder the men, but to sell them. So they could not only have female and children slaves on their own, they could make a profit off of the men that they would sell. And the West picked up on that, and they would buy these African men on the market and ship them back to England and Europe and in America. And there were even, ultimately, as time progressed, there were Westerners who would go in and do the work themselves instead of waiting for a war to take place and wait and buy the captives from particular tribes. They would go in and capture, kidnap people, and enslave them and bring them back to the West to serve our economic needs. It was involuntary. You couldn't. It was involuntary to get in, and you couldn't get out very, very easily. We'd have to. Sometimes masters would free their slaves, but it was never something that you could do yourself. You couldn't buy your own freedom. You couldn't get. This was something that would be dependent on the mercy of your master. Yeah.
Voluntarily gotten into it, but then if they had realized, then it turned involuntary?
I don't know. All I do know is that there was, by the time we get to this close to the Civil War era, I mean, it's an industry. It's,
right.
You're taking humans, you're treating them like cattle, you're enslaved, you're making them your workhorses.
Yeah, I was getting at the point of involuntarily. It could have been voluntary, and then they realized.
Yeah. Second thing here is it's the what drove the process was the economic need of the elites, the wealthy. That was the motive for having a slave class. The South, the entire economy depended on having a free workforce that you didn't have to pay for. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't mean just to specify the South. It was right. Only toward the Civil War was there a kind of division between free state and enslaved state, and even that wasn't a hard and fast division. Yeah, I mean, yeah, there was an indentured servitude in which. It was, you know, indentured servitude, and kind of it's almost. We'll talk more about this as we go on, but indentured servitude or was a different, more much longer lasting, or much more historic institution. There had always been this system in most societies where if you fell into debt or you were impoverished, you could loan yourself out to a person to be his slave for a certain set period of time. Right. We're going to see it's a very different thing, though, than what actually developed out of this slave trade, which then became, again, it was a debt slave has a level of volition and to get in and a level of volition to get out. The chattel slave is what this is.
Right.
has no volition. That's really the third. It's the first, but I want to do give a third category. It's kind of total ownership. The slave didn't own anything. The slave couldn't buy anything. The slave couldn't sell anything. The slave couldn't save money. Everything that the slave had belonged to the master. Everything the slave was he was literally cattle, legally as well as just in the way he was treated. He was legally a piece of property.
And of course, there's the element of American slavery that is different from slavery in the ancient world, that it was attached to race.
Yes. That's the fourth.
Benjamin Franklin could run away from his entropy and eventually serve, but his face for it was Marx's being quote unquote.
And then there were just.
In some cases in the ancient world, but very rarely was slavery associated with a color of skin or an ethnicity. So this was a new thing. And it was justified and propped up, unfortunately, you probably heard this, by Christian teaching, by men and women in the West, or men, pastors in the West, who preached that the Bible establishes not only the institution of slavery itself, but further justifies the idea that people who are darker in their complexion are lower on the scale of humanity. It's kind of a hierarchy of race and ethnicity. And black people, they argued, were on the lower scale, intended by God to be the servants of those with white skin. Can anyone think of a text that might have been used to do that?
Aristotle.
In the Bible.
There's something
about Ham. Ham, right. One of Noah's sons was named Ham, and he was, if you remember Noah, after Noah's flood, or after the flood of Noah's day, Noah, he was a good, righteous man and everything, but he enjoyed his wine, and he enjoyed it too much, and he got drunk naked in his house, and one of his sons, Ham, went in and mocked him, came out and told his other brothers, and they were laughing about it, but his two other brothers decided not to humiliate their father, and so they walked backwards with a blanket to cover their father up while he was drunk. And so when Noah woke up, instead of taking the blame on himself and saying, well, maybe I should have gotten drunk and naked, he decides to curse Ham and bless his other two sons. And Ham, as it turns out, if you read the genealogy, is the father of the African races. So this curse, some pastors would argue, justified the institution of slavery, which is already in the Bible, being shifted over to and being exclusively the property of those of the African of African descent. The darker skinned among us are the descendants of Ham, and so they should be our servants. That was the argument.
Jewish too, right?
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, there was a lot of inconsistency in the logic, and right. And it's not. We'll see as we go through this that was a completely. It was not a good reading of the Bible. I mean, you know this. People can use the Bible to argue for anything. The question is whether they're using the Bible correctly, and we need to be able to interpret the Bible rightly and test interpretations by what the Bible actually says. This was one of those cases where it was misinterpreted, but the misinterpretation was powerful because the South's economy, I mean, the economy, not just the South, again, as you were pointing out, and the economy of Europe, and then early in the period, and then in America later on, depended on slave labor. So it makes sense to buy into this interpretation of Scripture. This was a grave, grave injustice, as you all know. But I think what we'll see over the course of today, tomorrow, and or next week, today, next week, and next Sunday, is that American chattel slavery, or European chattel slavery based on race, bears very little resemblance to the kind of slavery that was common in the ancient Near East during the era when the Old Testament was written and the Old Testament law was given, and very uncommon or very not much like the Roman system at all during the New Testament era. So we'll see some differences. And in fact, I think the most dramatic difference that we're going to see is with regard to the Old Testament law and slavery. And we're going to see this word slave that we have become familiar with meant a very, very different thing to people in the ancient world than it means to us today. All right, so let's just begin, first of all, by making sure we've identified the problem correctly. So let's go to Genesis, as we always do. Genesis 2. Genesis 1 is the overview of creation. God creates the world in these six-day periods, and then at the end of the creation process, he creates Adamah, man, male and female. At the end of chapter 1, he tells them, he gives them dominion over the plants of the field and the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and the animals of the land. And he says, the end, this is verse 29 of chapter 1. I'm sorry, I meant chapter 1, but okay. Verse 29, and God said, behold, I've given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food, and to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps in the earth, everything that has breath of life, I've given every green plant for food. So man is given dominion over the created order. Now chapter 2 goes back and gives us the detail of the creation of humanity. And you read in verses 5 through 9 that God creates man out of the dust of the ground and breathes life into his nostrils. And then we get a little geographical detail there in verses 10 through 14. And then verse 15 is where I want to focus here. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. Now this is pre-fall. Sin has yet to enter the earth, enter the world. So what does that tell us about God's understanding or What does this tell us about work? What does this tell us about living? It's good, right? It's good. What this tells us about labor is that God has given it to humanity as a good thing. He planted Adam in this garden, told him to work it, and it wasn't. This is before sin has come into the world. Now, just look forward at in chapter 3, verse 17 and 18. After the curse comes into the created order, thorns and thistles grow up, and work becomes toilsome and frustrating. But this is before that, and so right now, I don't know how many of you guys have a job you like. Okay, now I have a job that I love. I don't love it every day. I mean, I don't love it every moment. But like in a general kind of sense, I have this contentment and joy in the job that I have. But I can remember times when I didn't. I remember I worked as a call receiver at Van Camp and American Capital Mutual Funds. And I hate money. I'm an introvert. And I don't work with money well. I'm an introvert. And I don't like to talk on the phone. So this was just the worst job. I hated going to work every morning. So I've experienced both. If you have a job you hate, you're experiencing that hatred of work that comes as a result of the fall. You would otherwise enjoy whatever work it is that you're given. If you have a job that you love, that you enjoy, then even though you have bad days, you can get kind of a taste, you kind of have a hint of the pure joy that Adam would have had working in the original garden. That's just kind of get a taste or a glimpse of it. So he's put there to work. Work is good. Now, God understands, however, that it's a big garden, and he has a lot of work. And so he creates a woman to do the dishes. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding, sorry. That was terribly sorry. Sorry. So he created woman, and it is to help. It is to help in this task of having dominion over the created order and working in the garden. She comes alongside him to support him and also to work herself. It's a unity. And also, not just that, notice what they're supposed to do. My favorite command in all of the Bible is increase and multiply. So they're supposed to, as a unit, make more little humans to go off and continue this work of exercising dominion and stewardship over God's creation, of enjoying themselves, working together as a family, producing fruit. Being cooperating together in the cool of the garden with the Lord, walking about, as it seems he does here in Genesis, in the garden with them. It's kind of this vision of the human community engaged together cooperatively in the stewardship of God's creation. Well, we know what happens. Chapter 3, the whole point of being in the garden was that they were to learn that God was going to give them good things, and they could trust him. And so the point of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was that they, faced with the option of not trusting God to give them good things, but seeking to know good things in their own, would then choose not to know what God has not given them to know, not to take the fruit that God has not given them to take, and just trust God to give them all good things. That was all they had to do. But instead, as you know, I won't go through the whole temptation sequence, but the serpent tempted Eve, who Adam is with her, so it's both their faults. Actually, it's Adam's fault, but God blames it on. So the serpent comes, tempts them with independence, with autonomy. Be your own man, be your own woman, you don't need God. You find out and discover what is good for yourself. You don't need him to show you what's good. And when you do that, you'll be like him, and he doesn't want you to have that, so why don't you do that? And so they believed him, and they went. And they ate the fruit. And then in let's look at verse 17. Another of my favorite passages. And to Adam he said, "Because you've listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree which I commanded you, you shall not eat it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field by the sweat of your face. You shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you are taken, for dust you are dust, and to dust you shall return." Here is the beginning of poverty. Here is the beginning of material depravity. Here is the beginning of limited resources. Here is the beginning of the frustrating, back-breaking, unproductive labor that we all hate. This is it. It's also the beginning, as you've heard before, but it's also the beginning of enmity between human beings. The fall didn't just create enmity between God and man and woman. It also created enmity between humans. We can see in the marriage relationship here in chapter 3. If you look up in verse 15. "I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring." And then if you go...
That's between the snake.
I'm sorry. Yep, wrong one. You're right. Thank you. Where is it here? There it is. Verse 16. "To the woman he said, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." And you see that word desire? That word is only in Hebrew repeated one more time in the Old Testament. And that's in chapter 4, where God comes to Cain. And in verse 7, says, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you. Do you see it? The word there is not talking about sexual desire or passionate desire. The curse is not that the woman shall have passionate desire for her husband. The curse is that she'll desire to overtake him and rule him and control him. And on the other side of that is that he shall rule over you. And the word for rule there doesn't mean benevolent rulership. It means he's going to be tyrant. So there's enmity now between the male and female in the garden. And that unfolds throughout the lives of their offspring and in our lives. So now you've got these two problems here. You've got human disharmony, to put it mildly, and lack of resources. So what do you think is going to happen?
War.
I mean, now, I'm not a Darwinian. This is pretty Darwinian, isn't it? Now you have survival of the fittest. Now you have the strong being able to take the resources from the weak.
We're going back to slavery, Matt.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. The abuse both ways, from male to female and female to male, begins here with the disconnect from God. That's how that happens. And, of course, Jesus puts that back together when he brings you back into relationship with him. So, lack of resources and human sin together create a situation in which the weak can be exploited by the strong and are exploited by the strong. And this sets the stage for what we know as slavery. If work is frustrating and not enjoyable, why not get the weak people to do it? Why not get the people that we can force into our own, into captivity, do the work for us? And their slavery is born. Questions so far? Thoughts? Okay, so now, that's just an overview of slavery in general as it begins in human history. I want to begin our discussion of slavery in the Old Testament with we've looked at the way, the motive and the purpose of slavery in the antebellum South. I want to, in a general sense, talk about slavery in the ancient Near East and what it tended to look like. But we're not here talking specifically about Israel. We're talking about ancient Near Eastern culture in general. The Hebrew situation was a little bit different, but it's important to get these ideas in our heads. As we've seen, just beginning with entry, in the antebellum South, entry into slavery was always involuntary. It was never something that a person would say, hey, take me across the sea, away from my family, in the hold of a boat, and never let me come back again. That's not something people would sign up for. But overwhelmingly, in the ancient Near East, slavery was a voluntary institution. There were some exceptions, which we'll talk about, but overwhelmingly, it was a voluntary situation. This was something that people set themselves into. The purpose of it was generally poverty. It was, if you had a bad harvest and you couldn't feed your kids, but your next door neighbor is wealthy, it would make sense to say, hey, can I work for you in exchange for taking care of my family? Can I give you my labor? Can I give you myself? I'll be your slave. That was one way people entered. Another way was because of debt. People would, in times of impoverishment, they would loan money from other wealthy people, and when they couldn't pay it back, what would he do? Well, there's no bankruptcy court, there's no way to deal with these things, so you go work for the person you owe money to until you pay that money off. There was, so poverty was the leading cause, but notice, as opposed to antebellum, slavery, it was not the economic need of the elite that drove it. In fact, in some cases, having a slave was burdensome to the wealthy. Can you think of why? I mean, yeah, you had to feed them, you had to give them health care. You had a big responsibility if you're going to take care of a slave. So it was rarely something that the elite would force people into. It was almost always something that people would seek out and enter into. So these two are very different, just in a broad ancient Near Eastern understanding of the thing. Secondly, what tends to happen, or thirdly, I guess, what tends to happen with regard to the person himself. In antebellum slavery, the person is owned. There's no sense in which this person is any longer a person. He's kind of an appendage of the master. He's your arm, he's your finger, he's your leg, he's your animal. In the ancient Near East, very rarely do you see that kind of, sometimes you do, but very rarely do you see that kind of total ownership of the person. What you generally see is ownership of labor. And one way this comes out very strongly is if you look at ancient Near Eastern legal codes, there are laws against abuse and killing of slaves. There were some codes against those sorts of things in the South too, but they were ignored. I mean, there was no one paid attention to them. In fact, the only case, I think there was I wrote it down, but there was a case in the United States where a master was charged by, I think it was South Carolina, for beating his slave to death, and it was a scandal. People in the South were shocked that a master would be actually charged in accordance to this law because it's a slave. Why, if he wants to beat the slave to death, he can beat the slave to death. It's his property. That's not there in the ancient world in general. In general, slave is considered another person who's given you his labor for a set period of time, usually, or life, but he's given you his labor. That's the transaction here. Say it's really not a bad thing, but I want to make an analogy. I'm not making this analogy. This is made in the source that I'm reading, which history of the ancient Near Eastern law. History of the Near Eastern, I'll get it in a minute. I'll read it to you. Imagine you're an employee in a corporation, and as an employee, you will bundle all of your workplace obligations, the contract under which you work, the values you are supposed to uphold, the relationships you have with coworkers at your office, your skills, your organizational knowledge, your career path. It all belongs to the firm that you work for. If, for example, that firm is sold to another firm, someone buys you out, there is, in this case, a property aspect to your life at the office, isn't there? Your labor is sold. Now, that doesn't mean that your family status as a father or a mother has changed. It doesn't mean you can't vote in your country. It doesn't mean that the laws that apply to everyone else don't apply to you. Your role and identity as a worker could be transferred or even inherited if the firm was privately owned in our system. And in that way, it's very analogous to an ancient Near Eastern slave system. What was being bought and sold was labor, not the individual. So the master very rarely, although in some places, some cases it happened, but the master very rarely had the power of life and death over his slave. He wasn't absolute property. Fourthly, it wasn't racial. Now here's an exception to that. Now if a nation conquered another nation, and you read about this in the Bible, they'll sometimes put them into quote-unquote slavery. Here's what that tended to mean. What that tended to mean is the Babylonians, when they took Jerusalem, they took the Israelites who lived there and they brought them to Babylon. What did they do in Babylon? They built the houses and worked their fields, and in fact, they're told, they're commanded, hey, Daniel says to the people in Israel, or I think it was Ezekiel, hey, plant your vineyards. Make a life there, because you're going to be there for 70 years. Don't just get used to it. Life there doesn't seem to have been enslavement. It was, as we would understand the word, it was you're a captive people, now you're living in Babylon, and you pay their taxes, and if they need you to do some work, they're going to draft some of your men to do it, but there's not a sense of you being owned as a nation group or as an ethnicity by the conquering nation. There were, of course, exceptions to that. Look, and the one exception to that, which comes up over and over again that we know of very well, is mentioned in our Bible. Can anyone think of what that exception is?
Egypt, right.
Egypt was unique among ancient Near Eastern civilizations with regard to the way they treated some of their slave classes, which looked very much like this chattel slavery that we've been talking about in the Antebellum South. Very much like it. You could kill a Hebrew slave. It was really your life was owned by the Pharaoh. But you'll notice the refrain, have read the first five books of the Old Testament. You'll notice over and over again that when God is imploring his people to treat the sojourner, the widow, and the orphan, and the weak with compassion, what basis does he give for that command?
That they were slaves in Egypt.
Remember, you too were slaves in Egypt. And so he's calling their mind back to this kind of chattel slavery, which was uncommon in the ancient Near East, and saying, don't be like that. Don't do that. All right, so by and large, it was not racial. That's ancient Near Eastern slavery in a general sense. Any question about this? Good. Okay. Well, let's go on then. One last thing we need to know, and that is this word slave. In Hebrew, it's ebed. This is something you got to be careful for when you're reading your Bible. Ebed is always translated slavery or slave in the ancient or in the Old Testament, but it's used. It has a much broader meaning than what you might expect. Persons occupied in the production of household work under the supervision of a patriarch would be called ebed. That's kind of like what we might assume. Household slave. But persons in subordinate positions in any context, often are referred to as slaves. So a king with his court, his kind of cabinet, his ministers, he would refer to them as his slaves, his ebeds. I mean, these guys would have powerful positions in the kingdom, and they would be wealthy and owning lots of stuff and calling lots of shots. But in this sense, that word ebed only means subordinate. I'm under the authority of this other person. I'm his ebed. I'm his slave. Ruth, who remembers the story of Ruth in the Old Testament? Ruth refers to herself as Boaz's ebed, his slave girl. But we've read that. What's he doing? What's she doing?
She's leaning.
She's leaning. Is Boaz behind her going, come on, Ruth, get that harvest in. No, I mean, she's very kind. She's free to come into his field and glean the remainder of the harvest behind his working men, then he doesn't bother. But she refers to himself as his Ebed. Abraham's servant. Who remembers who Abraham's servant is?
Eliezer.
Remember, he's upset because God has not fulfilled his promise yet and given him an heir. And so in Genesis chapter 15, he's complaining to God. He's saying, all right, well, I'm old now, and my wife's not going to have any babies now, and you haven't fulfilled your promise. And so Eliezer is going to be my what?
My heir.
Now, Eliezer is also referred to as his Ebed, his slave. Now, can you imagine a slave owner in the antebellum South considering one of his chattel slaves out in the field to be the heir of his estate? No way. The word is used in a very different way with a lot of different range of meanings. And so, again, we don't want to read the understanding of antebellum slavery into the word. In general, we want to say it means subordinate. And we'll have to interpret what type of subordination by the context of the text. That make sense? All right, so there's three types of Ebeds when we're talking about the context of servitude in the Old Testament. There's a native Ebed. A native debt Ebed. There is a foreign Ebed and a foreign debt Ebed. The Old Testament scriptures will notice do make a distinction between a Hebrew slave and a foreign slave. A Hebrew slave that's a debt slave and a Hebrew slave that's a slave for other reasons. Let's talk about, let's remind you about those two reasons why someone might enter into slavery in the ancient Near East. What was the first one? Who remembers?
Poverty.
Like you want to be helped. And then the other one is because you owe somebody something. Now, there were different laws that applied to these two groups in different ways in our Old Testament. And what I'd like to do is take some time to look through some of the texts that deal with the first class. I should have reversed this. Well, these two kind of go together. Let's take some time to look at the texts that deal with the native Ebed and the native debt Ebed, okay? And what we're going to look at first is the motive. What is the motive for slavery? Is it to help the elite, or is it for the help of the slave? And here I want you to turn to Deuteronomy 15, verses 4 through 5. Deuteronomy 15, verses 4 through 5. This is just a general principle, and we'll get some specific commands as we go on. You've seen this before. This is a command to all Israel. There shall be no poor among you, for the Lord will bless you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess, if only you will strictly obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandment that I will command you today. So first of all, notice that the motive which drove the vast majority of cases of slavery in the ancient Near East is illegal in Israel. This is a command. There shall be no poor among you. If there are poor, you're wrong, because it means you're not following the covenant that he's given you. So in poverty, if there's a poor person in Israel, that's already a sign of the problem. Okay, but God is a realist. So if you're in Deuteronomy 15, look down at verse 11, and he knows that his people are not going to follow the law. And so he says, there will always be poor among you. You're going to have poor people because you're disobedient. You're going to disobey my law, and you're going to find yourself in places of poverty and impoverishment. That's what's going to happen. And so, in that same chapter, notice in verses, I think it's verses preceding verse 11 there, tell me if I'm wrong, I forgot to put the verse numbers. If there's a poor man among you, look at this command, if there's a poor man among you, or among your brothers, in any of the towns of the land that the Lord your God is giving you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward your poor brother. Rather be open-handed and freely lend him whatever he needs. Do you hear that? You see where I am? Someone give a verse number in case you don't.
7.
Okay. That's a command. A command to all Israelites. Do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward your poor brother. Rather be open-handed and freely lend to him whatever he needs. There will always be poor among you. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed toward your brothers and toward the poor and the needy in your land. Now, this may mean, this open-handedness, may mean that lending somebody money becomes giving. But the command stands anyway. Turn to Deuteronomy 15, verse 10. This is verse 9. Be careful not to harbor a wicked thought. The seventh year for canceling debts is near, so that you do not show ill will toward your needy brother and give him nothing. Now, why would that be a concern?
Because you get released every 7 years.
You get released. The debt, every debt is canceled that you owe every 7 years. So let's just say you have money, and your poor brother comes to you, he's out of money, and it's year 6. And he says, hey, I need $1,000 to get out of my jam here. I'm going to be in trouble. Will you loan it to me? I promise I'll pay you back. What do you say?
Come next year.
Come next year. I'll have the money for you, not now. But this says you cannot do that. You must give money if you have it. If you don't have it, you can't give it. But if you have the money, give it to your poor brother. Absolute command. If he's in need. Now, of course, there might be, don't want to give to a shyster, but we're talking about in an ideal sense in which there is need. Now, turn to Exodus 23. What we're doing now is we're just laying out the provisions God made to prevent any kind of slavery from ever having to be a problem. To prevent the need to be dependent in an utter way on someone else. Exodus chapter 23, verse 10.
Can't need be very subjective?
Need can be subjective, but we're, when the word...
Who's to judge what the need is? The person giving or the person taking?
That's a great question. I mean, that's a great question, but we... he's asking, who's to judge need? How do you know whether the person really needs the money if they come and ask you? That's a great question. And I think that one of the reasons that Israel had leaders is so that they could help adjudicate those questions. Is this person really in need? Is this person not in need? Is this person trying to cheat you out of some money? Or is this person really, really having to have it? Yeah.
It's also, I'm sorry. I just say it's also subjective whether you have the money or not. Does that mean, could you eke it possibly?
Right.
Does it mean, I have to go into my 401k and
sure.
Borrow it?
Sure. You know? Well, right now, what we're talking about right now is case law. What I want to back up from is just look at the principle here. What's the principle that God is teaching? There should be no poor among you, and that if you have the means, you're obligated to help, and you can't let your consideration of whether or not you're going to get the money back that you owe, you're owed. Govern your decision, yes.
Yeah, the point is having faith in God mainly, in Jesus. So if someone's asking you for the money, whether they're shysting you or not, it's not up to your discretion. That's their will and that's where they're walking. That's their path that they're walking down. So if you give them the money and they don't pay you back, if you have it to offer, I'm sure God will give it back.
I mean, to an extent, I agree with you, yes. If someone's cheating you, they're going to be paying for it from God's perspective.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't want to get into... I just want to continue laying out the principle, though, right now. All right, so chapter 23 of Exodus. For 6 years, you're to sow your fields and harvest the crops, but during the seventh year, let the land lie unplowed and unused. Then, why is this? Because then the poor among your people may get food from it, and the wild animals may eat what they leave. Do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. So every 7 years, the people of Israel are commanded not to harvest, or not to, I mean, to let it lie fallow and let the poor of the land come and get all they need. I mean, in fact, if you had lost your seed that you used to plant the next year's crops as a poor person, you'd be destitute. But here, you could probably come and replenish your supply of seed. You could get back on your feet if you lost everything every 7 years. Every seventh year.
Is there any evidence that they did this?
Very little. I mean, in fact, it seems like that they may have for a while when they first got there, but by the time you get to the era of the kingdoms, no way, this wasn't done. Leviticus 25, verse 6. Same command here, whatever the year of the land yields during the Sabbath year will be, the Sabbath year is the year you don't plant. You just let the land grow as it will, and people are free to come and take it. Whatever the land yields during the Sabbath year will be food for you, for yourself, for your manservant, your maidservant, and the hired worker and the temporary resident who live among you. Now, there's also in chapter 10, if you don't have to follow me, this is going to be too much turning for you, you don't have to, but in Leviticus 19, verse 10, what happens if you find yourself impoverished between that six-year period? You have the Sabbath year. You have the Sabbath year. What happens if you run out of money, like, here?
You voluntarily go into slavery?
Chapter 3, well, actually, no. There's something else here. In Leviticus 19, verse 10, this is also in Deuteronomy 24, when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap... Am I in the right place?
That's 9.
Hmm?
That's verse 9.
Okay. I think I'm actually in the wrong place. Don't worry, I gave you the wrong, text. Let me tell you what the text says that I'm trying to go to. I think it's in chapter 20. We read it recently in men's Bible study. I think it's in chapter 28 of Deuteronomy. On the third year, everybody was supposed to bring all the harvest of the third year to the center of whatever village they live in and leave it, both the harvest of the barley and the harvest of the wheat. Leave it there for the poor and the homeless and the sojourner and the orphan of the land to come and take it. So third year, there was also this time when you could get yourself back on your feet if you needed to. The section I sent you to in Leviticus 19, beginning in verse 9, was, when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the alien. So there's this, even during the harvest year, the 2 years between the third year giveaway, the people, when they work their lands and harvest their fields, have to leave the edges of the field undone, and they don't go over them twice so that the poor can eat. Finally, if you're still in Leviticus, go to Leviticus 25, verse 33. And you'll notice there, if one of your countrymen becomes poor and is unable to help him support himself, help him as you would an alien or a temporary resident so he can continue to live among you. Verse 36, do not take any interest of any kind from him. So you loan money to a poor person, you can't say, all right, well, you haven't paid me back in a year, so I don't want 10% over and above what I gave you. You can't do that. Secondly, verse 37, you must not lend him money at interest or sell him food at a profit. Do you see that? So you can't charge a poor person over and above what it costs you to produce that food or to get that food. It's only cost. Are we out of time already? Darn it. Okay, so I do want to look at one last thing before we go. And that is the first command with regard to slaves. And that is in Deuteronomy chapter 15, I'm sorry, no, I'm sorry, wrong. It's in Leviticus 25, I'm so sorry. All my verse numbers are mixed up here. It's Leviticus 25, verses 35 through 43. Leviticus 25, verse 35 to 43. Chuck, what?
I don't know if this is a dumb statement or not, you know, but let the people give them a job to work, you know. So if you give them money, they'll come back right away, expecting you again to give them more money. Are you lost?
I'm sorry, I'm trying to look at the passage. You get very little time. I'm sorry.
Go on.
Okay, okay. Verse 25. I'm sorry, I'm so upset that it is. Okay, verse 35, chapter 25 of Leviticus. If your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall support him as though he were a stranger and a sojourner. No, this is not the passage. I'm so frustrated with myself. I am so sorry. There is a passage, and I thought it was here, and I'll have to have it next week. Where, when your brother comes to you and says, I can't afford to support myself, you must take him into your house and let him be your Eben.
Right.
You are required by law not to turn him away. If he becomes poor, he must be given, if you can, again, the means. It means you must allow him to become your slave, Ebed. Pay for his health care, pay for his food, give him lodging, not only him but also his family, for the entire time that he needs it, really. And we'll talk about that more next week. I'm sorry. I'm going to go back and check out my scriptural references. I apologize to you. I thought this was all ironed out. I worked it out yesterday, and I was frenzied, so... sorry about that, but I will have all the scriptural references done next week. Any questions or thoughts before we go? Is this helpful?